Last week we saw that even the great example of faith, the great model of faith, the great King David that is viewed even to this day as the greatest king that Israel ever had, that he also was a sinful human, just like the rest of us. We see that his power got to his head and he took things that didn't belong to himself, that he didn't deserve. Especially, we saw that in the story of David and Bathsheba, where he lusted after a woman and had her husband killed so that he could have her. We saw the results of that in chapter 11 and chapter 12, where he was approached by the prophet Nathan, and he recognized his sin, he confessed his sin, he repented of his sin, but yet he still had to deal with the consequences of that sin, which included that the child that Bathsheba was going to bear was going to die. And so we saw that happen. But we also see a condemnation as well in chapter 12, starting in verse 11. It said, this is what Nathan said that God had said, "Out of your own household, David, I'm going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all of Israel." So sin brought repercussions, brought consequences that David would have to deal with, would have to live with, and he, the same sin that he committed against Uriah would be committed in broad daylight against him. And so today we're going to see the result of that. We're going to see some of the consequences of David's poor discernment in this sin and just in being a sinful human. And we'll see that these problems come from his own family. We'll be going through chapters 13 through 18, so we've got a lot of ground to cover, so strap on your seatbelts and let's go. Let's just dive right in, chapter 13. And we see that right after the story of David and Bathsheba that we have in chapters 11 and 12, we now dive right into these stories of what happened with his children as a result of his problems. So we start out, we have Amnon, who is David's oldest son. Okay, he's the heir apparent. You see that back at the beginning of the book in 2 Samuel chapter 3, verses 2 to 3, verses 2 through 5, give you some of the lineage of his sons, and then you've got some more in chapter 5, verses 14 to 15, and that's where you see his sons listed. And you see that the oldest son is Amnon, and we see in chapter 13 that in the course of time, Amnon, the son of David, fell in love with Tamar, the beautiful sister of Absalom, who was also the son of David. Therefore, he fell in love with his sister. It was a half-sister, a sister by another mother, but the same father. Amnon became frustrated to the point of illness on account of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible for him to do anything to her. So he had a crush. He fell in love, or so he thought, with Tamar, okay, his half-sister. Well, and it preoccupied him, and he obsessed about it, so that eventually a friend, a good friend of his, who happened to be his cousin, Jonadab, gave him a suggestion. And we see that going on. Verse 3. "Now Amnon had a friend named Jonadab, son of Shimea, who was David's brother." Okay, therefore, Jonadab was Amnon's cousin. "Jonadab was a very shrewd man. He asked Amnon, 'Why do you, the king's son, look so haggard morning after morning? Won't you tell me?' Amnon said to him, 'Oh, I'm in love with Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister.'" "Okay, go to bed. Pretend to be ill," Jonadab said. "When your father comes to see you, say to him, 'I would like my sister Tamar to come and give me something to eat. Let her prepare the food in my sight so that I may watch her and then eat it from her hand.'" Okay, so here was a suggestion of how he could get close to Tamar. Is just act like you're sick. When your dad comes to check up on you, just, you know, he'll grant you a wish or a desire and just say, I'd like my sister to come prepare some food for me. Okay? And so that's what you have. He does that. He follows through with that in the next few verses through verse 10. And then what happens? Well, he's in love with her, so he makes some advances. How does Tamar respond to those advances? I'll pick it up in verse 10. "Amnon said to Tamar, bring the food here into my bedroom so that I may eat from your hand. Now, there's the first bad move right there. And Tamar took the bread she had prepared and brought it to her brother Amnon in his bedroom. But when she took it to him to eat, he grabbed her and said, "Come to bed with me, my sister." "Don't, my brother," she said to him. "Don't force me. Such a thing should not be done in Israel. Don't do this wicked thing. What about me? Where could I get rid of my disgrace? And what about you? You would be like one of the wicked fools in Israel. Please, speak to the king. He will not keep me from being married to you." Okay? So he made advances, and Tamar said, no, we can't do this. This is not right. It's not right in Israel. It's not right in God's eyes. And she obviously was concerned for herself, because an unmarried woman who was not a virgin was not marriable. Okay, was not she was tainted. And so what would happen to her? She would be disgraced for the rest of her life. She'd be outcast. She'd be unmarriable. And what about him? Okay, he'd be like one of the fools of Israel. Who's he? He's supposed to be the next king, right? Or he's the one in line to be the next king. He's the heir apparent. So, and she says, "Look, Dad's not going to stop us from being married. If you want to marry me, then ask him. He will let you." Okay. So did that satisfy Amnon? Going on, verse 14. But he refused to listen to her, and since he was stronger than her, he raped her. Then Amnon hated her with intense hatred. In fact, he hated her more than he had loved her. Amnon said to her, "Get up and get out." "No," she said to him, "sending me away would be a greater wrong than what you've already done to me." But he refused to listen to her. So you see what happens here. And so he ends up raping her. And you see here, it's not love, it's lust that he's got. And then once he's done the dirty deed, then he hates her with a greater hatred than what he had loved her with before. And so she casts him out. The next verse is he calls in one of the servants and locks the door behind her and sends her on her way. Okay. Well, Tamar was concerned if something like this happened, what might happen to her life? Her life would be destroyed. Well, what happened? Verse 19. Tamar put ashes on her head and tore the ornamented robe that she was wearing. She put her hand on her head and went away, weeping aloud as she wept. So you see, these are signs of mourning. Tearing your robe, putting ashes on your head, holding your head in your hand, going on. Verse 20, her brother Absalom, okay, he was the full brother, said to her, "Has that Amnon, your brother, been with you? Be quiet now, my sister. He's your brother. Don't take this thing to heart." And Tamar lived in her brother Absalom's house, a desolate woman. So just as she thought, and her life was destroyed by this one act. And her brother Absalom consoled her and tried to calm her. Well, how did Absalom feel about it? He told Tamar not to worry about it. And how did David feel about it when he heard what happened? Verse 21. When King David heard all this, he was furious, as you would expect. Absalom never said a word to Amnon, either good or bad, but he hated Amnon because he had disgraced his sister Tamar. Okay? So Amnon was quiet about it. He kept it to himself, but he hated Amnon. And as you might imagine, especially with Tamar living in his house, as time goes on, he just hates him more and more and more, and it builds on itself and builds on itself. You see that King David was furious about this. So, but you also see he doesn't do anything about it. He's mad, but you don't see any discipline there. Why not? Well, let's go back to the previous chapter that we looked at last week, and we'll just look at verse 9. This is Nathan talking to David, and he says, "Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You, David, struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword, and you took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites." So why might David not have reacted in discipline and strong discipline that was deserved to his son Amnon for raping his sister? Because David had a bad past and had this guilt of having sinned greatly with a woman before. Okay, so you see, it's permeating the family here. It's going on beyond just the one situation that David had with Bathsheba. Well, as you would expect, it just grows and grows. This hatred that Absalom has for Amnon just grows and grows, and finally he takes a chance and takes revenge on Amnon. We see that in the next verses. We'll skip a bunch of these verses, but you can see in verse 23 that 2 years later, so 2 years pass, and Absalom's sheep shearers were at Baal Hazor near the border of Ephraim, and he invited all the king's sons to come there. Now when it's sheep shearing time, that's party time, okay? And so he invited everyone to come to the party. In the next verses you see that he went to his dad and said, "Hey dad, everybody come." And his dad said, no, I'm be too big of a burden. He says, "Well, at least let my brothers come." And so they come, and then verse 28, Absalom ordered his men, "Listen, when Amnon is in high spirits from drinking wine, and I say to you, strike Amnon down, then kill him. Don't be afraid. Have not I given you this order? Be strong. Be brave." Okay? So Amnon was one of the sons, one of the king's sons, one of the princes, one of his brothers that had come to this party. And this is the key reason why he threw this party. And you see this premeditation here. And he tells his servants, okay, when Amnon's drinking, when he's drunk, strike him down when I tell you. Okay? Don't be afraid. You won't get in trouble because I'm the one who's given the command. You're just following my command. So they do it. And how is that action interpreted by Absalom's brother and the people as well? Verse 29. So Absalom's men did to Amnon what Absalom had ordered. Then all the king's sons got up, mounted their mules, and fled. While they were on their way, the report came to David, "Absalom has struck down all the king's sons. Not one of them is left." Okay, you see how things get exaggerated through the grapevine as a message is passed on and people add to it and add to it. It says, "Absalom's killed all the king's sons." The king stood up, tore his clothes, and lay down on the ground. All his servants stood by with their clothes torn. Okay, so what do they think was happening here? Well, everyone knew that, you know, the people had seen that Absalom had had Amnon killed. Well, why would he do that? Well, Amnon is the heir apparent. He's the next in line to become king. So, well, Absalom's not number two. Okay, Absalom is number three. So there may be others in line there. But then once you try to take the reign this way, well, what does that open the door for? It opens the door for others who want to be king to maybe come kill you. So if you're trying to be king, you just wipe out everybody else who might be a threat to you. And that's what they thought was happening here. And so the word spread that Absalom has killed all the king's sons. But he hadn't. He had only killed Amnon. Who understood that, what had really happened and why? Verse 32. Jonadab. Okay, Jonadab, we've seen him before. He was the one who gave Amnon the advice to call a sister in. Jonadab, son of Shimeah, David's brother, said, "My lord should not think that they killed all the princes. Only Amnon is dead. This has been Absalom's expressed intention ever since the day Amnon raped his sister Tamar. My lord the king should not be concerned about the report that all the king's sons are dead. Only Amnon is dead." The next verses then we see confirmation of that, and word comes to the king that says, no, all the king's sons, and actually all the king's sons come, and they realize that it was just Amnon that was killed. But nonetheless, Absalom is now a murderer. He has had his brother killed. So he's not safe. So where does he run away to protect himself from being executed for this? Verse 37. Absalom fled and went to Talmai, son of Ammihud, the king of Geshur. But King David mourned for his son every day. After Absalom fled and went to Geshur, he stayed there for 3 years. So he ran away to Geshur. He went to live with Talmai, the king of Geshur. And if you look back at the beginning of 2 Samuel chapter 3, you see, well, who was this Talmai guy? Well, in verse 3, you see that Absalom was the son of Maakah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. So where did he go to protect himself? He went to his grandfather's house. Okay. We see that this is one example where David had married the daughter of a king to provide a political alliance there, and Absalom was the result of that, and as well as Tamar. Well, did David hold a grudge against Absalom? Verse 39, and the spirit of the king longed to go to Absalom, for he was consoled concerning Amnon's death. So over these 3 years, David had made peace with the fact that Amnon had been killed, and he longed for Absalom. He loved his son and wanted his son to come back to him and wanted to see his son. But it wasn't right for him to bring him back. Absalom was a murderer. He had killed his brother. But someone helped devise a scheme to bring to David's attention and to help David decide that it was okay for Absalom to come back. Who did that? Chapter 14. Joab, son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart longed for Absalom. Who was Joab? Joab, remember, was the commander of David's armies. He had a couple of brothers, one who's dead at this time, one other who's still around, and we'll see a little bit more of him. And that's why you see son of Zeruiah, that kind of reminds us who these brothers are. So he knew that David's heart longed for Absalom, so he sent someone to Tekoa, okay, which is a town just a little south of Bethlehem, and had a wise woman brought from there. He said to her, pretend that you're in mourning. Dress in mourning clothes and don't use any cosmetic lotions. Act like a woman who's spent many days grieving for the dead. And then go to the king and speak these words to him. And Joab put the words in her mouth. Okay, so he creates this fake story, creates this ruse, and gets someone who would go in and present David with this situation that would convince him to do to bring Absalom back. So what was that story? What was this fake story that Joab gave her to tell David? Verse 5. The king asked her, what's troubling you? She said, I am indeed a widow. My husband is dead. I, your servant, had two sons. They got in a fight with each other in the field, and no one was there to separate them. One struck the other and killed him. Now the whole clan has risen up against your servant. They say, hand over the one who struck the brother down so that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed. And then we'll get rid of the heir as well. They would put out the only burning coal that I have left, leaving my husband neither name nor descendant on the face of the earth. The king said, go home, and I'll issue an order in your behalf. And she goes on and says, well, then let the king invoke the Lord his God to prevent the anger of blood from adding to the destruction so that my son will not be destroyed. Okay, so she paints this picture that she's a widow, no husband, and her two sons were fighting. One of them accidentally, or one of them killed the other. And now the town people want him dead. Okay, want to punish him with capital punishment to kill him for the murder that he did. And she doesn't want her son to die because he's her son. And he's also the only son, the only remaining part of the lineage of her husband. And so she presents that, and David says, yes, you're right. I will protect you. I will protect your son. I'll put an edict out that says that nobody can harm a hair on his head. And she goes, well, okay, thank you. But also, could you swear to God, okay? Could you swear to God and call down a curse on anyone who might try to catch revenge on my son for killing his brother? So does this sound a little familiar? You know, two brothers, one brother killing another, and one of them who deserves to die for the murder, but the parent doesn't want them dead, and that kind of thing? Well, that's this picture that Joab had the woman paint, so that he's making this decision, and then he'll find out, hey, this is really a story about you, and that will incite David to bring his son back. Has David encountered something like this before? Yes, we saw that back last week in chapter 12, after the whole Bathsheba incident. Now, you see in chapter 12 that Yahweh sent Nathan, the prophet, to David. When he came to him, he said, there were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb that he had bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food and drank from his cup. It even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. This is all he had. Now, a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die." Right? I mean, that's a horrible thing that that rich man did. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity. Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you over heaven, and then you've killed Uriah for his wife." Okay, God's blessed you, but then you went and took the only blessings that someone else had. So here he's seen this same kind of, third-party story that convicts him and convicts him of his guilt or convicts him to do something. Well, that's the tactic that Joab's taken with this woman. So, the woman has presented the case. David has made the ruling that Joab was expecting David to make. And so now the woman informs David, but also kind of puts a little twist on his faith here too to put a little extra force into what David needs to do here. Verse 13. The woman said, "Then, why have you devised such a thing like this against the people of God? When the king says this, does not he convict himself? For the king has not brought back his banished son. Like water spilled on the ground that cannot be recovered, so we must die." Okay, so Amnon's dead. You can't bring him back. Exiling Absalom or having him executed or any of that isn't going to bring Amnon back. Okay? But God does not take away life. Instead, he devises ways so that a banished person may not remain estranged from him. Okay, so she says that, God doesn't want you to punish Absalom. But God doesn't want you to keep him away from you. Okay, what's done is done. You can do whatever you want, but Amnon's not coming back. It's like water spilled on the ground. You cannot recover that. Okay, so God wants to bring restoration. God wants to bring the estranged person back to him. You should do the same. Okay? So is she right? She's talking about atonement here, right? That God wants to bring us back to him. Is she correct in saying that God does not support punishment of Absalom? Even capital punishment, which is what he would deserve, right? I'll go back to Genesis chapter 6. Let's go to the very, very beginning. Chapter 9, verse 6. God says, "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made man." So was she right? No, she was stretching the truth here. Okay, it wasn't important that she tell the truth here. She's trying to get David to decide something. So she was twisting words to make her point here. God instituted capital punishment, you see there. Well, was the woman correct about God trying to find ways to reconcile the banished? Well, turn to Romans chapter 5, starting at verse 6. You see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous man, though for a good man, someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this, that while we were still sinners, we didn't deserve anything, Christ died for us. Since we have now been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through him? For if when we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to him through the death of his son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through his life? Not only is this so, but we also rejoice in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received reconciliation. Okay? So God has reconciled us to him through the death of his son. It is true that God does not want to see people removed from him. Even though our sin separates us from him, he wants us to come back to him. He offers his atonement. He offers his forgiveness. He offers to bring us back, and he did something about it. He came to us by sending his son, Jesus Christ, to die for us. You see also in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 13, Paul says, "But now in Christ Jesus, you who were once far away have been brought near through the blood of Christ." Okay, just as Absalom is far away from David, you know, we have been far away from God, but God has brought us near through the blood of Jesus. Okay, so you see the atonement that that God has instituted. So the woman is telling some truth, but she's twisting it and throwing some falsehood in there to try to get David to bring Absalom back. So how does David respond to this woman trying to manipulate his actions this way? Verse 19. The king said, "Isn't the hand of Joab with you in all this?" It's pretty obvious that, okay, you wouldn't just come on your own, and what you're doing here is what I would expect out of Joab. And he's kind of been bugging me to bring back Absalom, and it just looks like Joab's behind this. Is that right? So he recognizes Joab's involvement in trying to restore the royal family. Joab being the commander of the army, it's important to keep peace in this family. Absalom, being in a faraway country, he represents a threat. He could decide that he wants to go ahead and become king. He wants to attack. He knows the inner workings of the government. He knows all the locations and the Achilles' heels of Jerusalem and those kind of things. So, and being far away, Joab is not able to keep a watch on him and protect the kingdom from him. So if we get Absalom back, he can watch him and he can take care of, protect the kingdom there. So I see that as being part of Joab's intent here. So did David accept this argument? Verse 21. The king said to Joab, "Very well, I'll do it. Go, bring back the young man Absalom." Then Joab went to Geshur and brought Absalom back to Jerusalem. But the king had said, "He must go to his own house. He must not see my face." So Absalom went to his own house and did not see the face of the king. So he brought him back, but he wouldn't see him and wouldn't let Absalom come visit him. Okay. Did Absalom care about that? Did he want to see his father? Verse 28. Absalom lived 2 years in Jerusalem without seeing the king's face. Then Absalom sent for Joab in order to send him to the king, but Joab refused to come to him. So he sent a second time, but he refused to come. So you see, he did want to see his dad and see the king. Here, he's next in line. Even though he was the third son, we don't ever see the second son anymore. We see the second son mentioned in the list of sons that were born, and this is Kileab that you see in 2 Samuel 3, verse 2 and 3. But we don't ever hear about him anymore. So the thought is that he was dead by this time, so that by killing Amnon, Absalom really is the next heir apparent. Okay? Well, if he's the heir apparent, if he's the son, he needs to get back in good graces with his dad if he wants to become king. You know, during these 5 years now, 3 years in Geshur, 2 more years in Jerusalem, where he hadn't seen his father, he's thinking that he needs to do something, and he's probably decided that he wants to become king, and he wants to do something about it. So he sends for Joab, tries to get Joab, because he can't just go see the king. He tries to get Joab to go and ask David if he could come see him. But Joab won't come. And then going on, verse 30, then he said to his servants, "Look, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go set it on fire. That'll get his attention." So Absalom's servant set the field on fire, and as you would expect, Joab did go to Absalom's house, and he said to him, "Why have your servant set my field on fire?" So that's one way to get Joab's attention. So why did he want to see his dad so badly? Verse 32. Absalom said to Joab, "Look, I sent word to you and said, 'Come here so that I can send you to the king to ask why have I come from Geshur. It would be better for me if I were still there. Now then, I want to see the king's face. And if I'm guilty of anything, well then let him put me to death.'" Okay, so he wanted to get full acceptance. It wasn't just, okay, now I got to come back to Jerusalem, but I can't do anything. I'm not really any closer to my father since I can't see him. I want him to decide, am I accepted or not? If I'm not accepted, if I deserve death for killing my brother, then execute me. But other than that, then restore me, and restore me fully. Okay, that's what he wanted. So did Absalom receive the full forgiveness that he wanted? Verse 33, so Joab went to the king and told him this. The king then summoned Absalom, and he came to him and bowed down with his face to the ground, and the king kissed Absalom, which shows acceptance. Okay, so he received his the acceptance that he wanted. Okay. So, Absalom is back in town, back in good graces with dad. He can see his dad. No longer does the rest of the world know that he and his dad don't get along, or that his dad has rejected him, because his dad has now accepted him. So he's next in line to be king. So being that he's next in line, is he sure that he's going to be king? Is that a certainty? Well, if you look back, well, how did David get to be king? Was that a certainty? Go back to 1 Samuel verse 23, verse 16. And you see that Saul's son Jonathan, who was the one who was next in line to be king, he was the heir apparent from Saul, went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. And he said, "Don't be afraid. My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You'll be king over Israel, and I'll be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this." So even before David became king, it was clear to Jonathan, who was the rightful heir to the kingship, at least as far as genealogies and dynasties go, that God had not chosen him, that God had chosen David, that David would become king. And he was fine with that. Okay? Well, what about now? Absalom would be the next in line, but it's not a certainty that he is going to be the next king. So what does he do to start making himself look like a king and start making it obvious and apparent to everybody that he's the natural choice, that he is the next king? Chapter 15. In the course of time, Absalom provided himself with a chariot and horses and with 50 men to run ahead of him. Okay, so whenever he would go somewhere, he was in this great chariot. Nobody had chariots. And with horses, only a king could have this kind of entourage, with 50 men who would run in front of him and get the people out of the way and prepare the pathway. It's kind of like rolling out the red carpet. So if you saw 50 men coming down the street getting people out of the way, what would you think? Somebody important. The king is coming. And so he made himself look like a king. Other kings did this back in those days, but not David. We don't ever see where David did something like this. So, did Absalom look like a king? Well, back in chapter 14, some verses that we skipped, in verse 25, it says that in all of Israel there was not a man so highly praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the top of his head to the sole of his foot, there was no blemish in him. Whenever he cut the hair of his head, he used to cut his hair from time to time when it became too heavy for him, he would weigh it, and its weight was 200 shekels. It's about 5 pounds by the royal standard. So we get this picture of someone who looks like a king. He's the most handsome man in the whole land. Okay, Prince Charming here we have. And having a lot of hair was a sign of vigor and vitality. And so you get that picture of him. Well, so he looked like a king, he acted like a king here. Now he also needed to get the people on his side. What did he do to get the people on his side, to win the people's hearts? Verse 2. He would get up early and stand by the side of the road leading to the city gate. Whenever anyone came with a complaint to be placed before the king for a decision, Absalom would call out to him, "Hey, what town are you from?" And he'd answer, "Your servants from one of the tribes of Israel." And then Absalom would say to him, "Oh, look, your claims are valid and proper, but there's no representative of the king to hear you." And Absalom would add, "If only I were appointed judge in the land, then everyone who has a complaint or a case could come to me, and I'd see that he gets justice." Okay, so he started, whenever people had troubles and would come to town to see the king, he started presenting himself as the champion of the common people. You know, if only they made me judge. If only I could I could judge your case, I would take care of you and make sure that justice was done and that you would win. And so people started becoming endeared to Absalom here. He's a champion of the common people. He's not one of these stuffy old princes and kings. And so starts to win the hearts of the people. Verse 5, also whenever anyone approached him to bow down before him, which is what you would do before a king or a prince, Absalom would reach out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. So in other words, he wouldn't let him bow down to him. He'd say, oh, look, I'm just like one of you. Come here. And he'd hug him and kiss him. And Absalom behaved in this way towards all the Israelites who came to the king asking for justice. And so he stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Okay? So he's playing the politician here. He's winning the people's hearts. He's presenting himself. If you make people think that you're something that you're not, well, then you are that something. Okay? He's trying to act like he's the king and wanting people to want him to be the king. So he gets all this public support. People are thinking of him as a king. And then he decides, okay, I'm going to be king. And so we see that he prepares a coup here. And we see that in verse 7 that at the end of 4 years, so he's there for 4 years, so he has plenty of time to win the people over and to prepare a group of people to rally around him and support him. And after 4 years, he says to the king, let me go to Hebron and fulfill a vow that I made to the Lord. While your servant was living in Geshur and Aram, I made this vow, if the Lord takes me to Jerusalem, I'll worship the Lord in Hebron. Okay, so he wants to go to Hebron. What's Hebron? Hebron's kind of a key gathering place for the people. Hebron is when David became king, when the men of Judah, the southern tribe of Judah, made David their king, they did that at Hebron. When later, the rest of the tribes of Israel made David their king, they did that at Hebron. Why Hebron? Well, if he wants to be king, if he wants to be announced as the next king, he goes to Hebron. That's the place where kings are crowned, right? But here, he can't say, hey, Dad, I'm going to Hebron so that everybody can call me king and you're not going to be king anymore. He can't do that. But he has to get permission to go. And so he says, I had made a vow to God. Okay, this is something Dad will support me on this. I made a vow to God to go to Hebron and worship him there. So can I go? Verse 9, the king says to him, go in peace. So he went to Hebron. Then Absalom sent secret messengers throughout the tribes of Israel to say, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpets, then say, Absalom is king in Hebron. Okay, so he made all this preparation. He went to Hebron and he sent messengers throughout the whole nation so that when the trumpet sounds and one town could hear the trumpet from the next town, it would be relayed. And then all of Israel would say, hey, Absalom's now the king. Has become king in Hebron. So he goes to Hebron. He brings a bunch of people with him. Do they know what's going on? Are they accomplices to his coup? Verse 11. 200 men from Jerusalem had accompanied Absalom. They had been invited as guests and went quite innocently, knowing nothing about the matter. While Absalom was offering sacrifices, he sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, to come from Gilo, his hometown. And so the conspiracy gained strength, and Absalom's following kept on increasing. So Absalom brought a bunch of people, a couple hundred nobles, a couple hundred important people to come with him. Well, they don't know anything about what's going on. When he announces that, hey, I'm king now, you know, won't they just say, no, you're not, David is? No, because when a coup happens like this, whoever's with him is with him and would be recognized as, oh, so, you know, by David would say, okay, would learn about Absalom declaring himself king in Hebron and would find out who are the people who are there with him who are supporting that. You know, if they were there, then it would look to David like they were in support. So these people are going to be involved in the coup whether they want to or not, because Absalom tricks them into coming there. You also see that Ahithophel, who was a counselor, an advisor to David, had come also innocently, but he then brought him into his fold. We see Ahithophel was someone who was his He was very well respected. His advice was respected. Chapter 16, verse 23 says that in those days the advice that Ahithophel gave was like that of one who inquires of God. That was how both David and Absalom regarded all of Ahithophel's advice. Okay, so he brought this advisor, key advisor. Now, who was Ahithophel? If you look at 2 Samuel 11, verse 3, and then also chapter 23, verse 34, you and put those together, you realize that Ahithophel was Bathsheba's grandfather. Okay, so there's a family connection there, too. So, Absalom stages this coup. How does David react when he hears of what Absalom's done? Verse 13, a messenger came and told David, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. Well, then David said to all his officials who were with him in Jerusalem, come, we must flee or none of us will escape Absalom. We must leave immediately or he will move quickly to overtake us and bring ruin upon us and put the city to the sword. Okay, as long as we're sitting here in Jerusalem, we're sitting ducks. Okay, he can come and attack us. Now, Jerusalem was a fortified city, but you can besiege a city and over the period of time, everyone in there will die or become weakened to where you can capture it. And David says, we got to get out of this city. The city's at risk because of us. We're sitting ducks because of us, of it. Plus, you know, David had a lot of experience fighting, and he had a lot of fighting men with him. But that fighting is better out in the open fields or out in the forest, out and about, not within a city. Okay? So he says, we got to get out of here. So we then see in verses 15 through 22 that he takes off and he's got this big entourage that that goes with him. And as they walk past the towns, they head east. They head east to the to go across the or basically to the banks of the Jordan River. And as they head that way, they pass towns, they pass people. And how did the people react when they saw David and his entourage leaving? Verse 23, it says, the whole countryside wept aloud as all the people passed by. The king also crossed the Kidron Valley, which is the big valley that's to the east of Jerusalem, and all the people moved on toward the desert. And then verse 30, but David continued up the Mount of Olives. This is on the other side of the Kidron Valley, weeping as he went. His head was covered and he was barefoot. All the people with him covered their heads too and were weeping as they went up. So everyone was very upset. Okay, they grieved that David was leaving. They grieved at what was happening here, this coup from Absalom. David cried. He walked barefoot. Walking barefoot was a sign of sorrow. Okay. Now we see in verses here that he does not take the Ark of the Covenant with him. Why not? Verse 24. Zadok was there too, okay, Zadok being the high priest here, and all the Levites who were with him were carrying the Ark of the Covenant of God. So as they left Jerusalem, they were carrying the Ark with them. They set down the Ark of God on the outside of the city, and Abiathar offered sacrifices until all the people had finished leaving the city. And then the king said to Zadok, take the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he'll bring me back and let me see it and his dwelling place again. But if he says, I'm not pleased with you, well, then I'm ready. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him. Okay? So, let's don't bring the Ark. The Ark doesn't have anything to do with what's going on here. If I'm in the wrong, if God is punishing me for something I've done to upset him, then so be it. And bringing the Ark isn't going to change that. But if I'm in the right and I'm a victim here and God wants me to be restored and be able to come see the Ark again, then he'll do that. So he leaves himself in God's hands. He trusts God to take care of him rather than trying to force God to come with him, which is what it would look like if he was trying to take the Ark. In fact, you remember that back in 1 Samuel chapter 4 when the Israelites tried to do that. Chapter 4 verse 3, we see that the Philistines had gone into battle and just mounted forces that were way, way, way overpowered the Israelites. And we see in verse 3 that when the soldiers returned to camp, the elders of the Israel asked, why did the Lord bring defeat upon us today before the Philistines? Let's bring the Ark of the Lord's Covenant from Shiloh so that it may go with us and save us from the hands of our enemies. So here, back then, they decided, and this is back in Samuel's day, or even when Samuel was young, that, hey, if we're going to beat the Philistines, we've got to have God with us. God wasn't with us on this previous battle, so let's go get him. Let's bring the Ark of the Covenant, and that will force God to be on our side, right? Well, they found out in verse 10 that the Philistines fought, and the Israelites were defeated, and every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. The Ark of God was captured, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died, Eli being the high priest. So they found out very quickly that you cannot force God to come to your side. Okay? It's God's side. Are we on God's side? That's what matters. And so by bringing the Ark of the Covenant was not going to bring God into the equation. Okay? The Ark, God is not the Ark. The Ark is not God. Okay. Was anyone, all the people were crying as David left. Was anyone happy to see David leave? Chapter 16, verse 5. As King David approached Bahurim, a man from the same clan of Saul's family came out from there. His name was Shimei, the son of Gera, and he cursed as he came out. He pelted David and all the king's officials with stones, though all the troops and special guard were on David's right and left. Kind of a stupid guy, right? I mean, here you've got the king leaving because of a coup attempt. He's got the army all around him. He's surrounded by soldiers. And what is this guy doing? He's cursing David and throwing rocks at David and all the soldiers. I mean, has this guy got a death wish or what? But you see what he is doing. And he says, verse 8, "The Lord has repaid you for all the blood that you shed in the household of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. The Lord has handed the kingdom over to your son Absalom. You have come to ruin because you are a man of blood." Okay, so he blamed David for Saul's death. He said, "You staged a coup. You killed off Saul and his family because you wanted to be king. Now it's going to happen to you." Okay, so he was cursing David as David went on. Now, was his cursing justified? Is that what had happened? Turn back to chapter 9, verse 3. We know at the end of chapter of 1 Samuel, you know, how did Saul die? Well, it wasn't at David's hands. And we saw back in 1 Samuel that over and over again, God gave opportunities to David to kill Saul, but he didn't because he respected the Lord's anointed. And he wouldn't raise his hand against the hair of the Lord's anointed, against Saul. And then after Saul had died by the hand of the Philistines, later on we see in chapter 9, David asks, "Is there no one still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness?" And Ziba answered the king, "Well, there is still a son of Jonathan. He's crippled in both feet." Verse 7, "Don't be afraid," David said to the son of Jonathan, who is named Mephibosheth, "for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table." So the one sole survivor of Saul's family, David sought him out and took care of him. He couldn't take care of himself because he was lame, and he gave him not only peace, but he allowed him to live in the palace and sit at his table and become part of the family. He gave him all of his grandfather's, all of Saul's land. So David had not done these horrible things against his predecessor's family. Instead, it was just the opposite. So, but Shimei was cursing him nonetheless because he had this grudge against David. Well, why did David let that go on? Why didn't, he's got all these soldiers around him. He's got Joab and Abishai, his brother, Joab's brother, who could go strike this guy down real easily. Why didn't he let him do that? Back to chapter 16, verse 9. "Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, 'Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and cut off his head.' But the king said, 'What do you and I have in common, you sons of Zeruiah?'" Remember, he didn't trust these guys, Joab and Abishai, anymore. And that all came from when Joab killed Abner, the commander of Saul's army, when Abner was trying to bring an alliance and between the two households. And so you see that David still doesn't trust these guys and says, "Hey, I got nothing to do with you," even though they were his relatives too. They were too powerful that he couldn't stop them and replace them. And he says to Abishai, if this guy is cursing because the Lord has said to him to curse David, well, then who can ask, why do this? David then said to Abishai and all his officials, my son, who is of my own flesh, is trying to take my life. How much more than this Benjamite? Leave him alone. Let him curse. For the Lord has told him to do so. It may be that the Lord will see my distress and repay me with good for the cursing that I'm receiving today. Okay. So David and his men continued along the road while Shimei was going along the hillside opposite them, cursing as he went, throwing stones at him and showering him with dirt. King and all the people with him arrived at their destination exhausted, and there he refreshed himself. So David said, yeah, I don't like that he's cursing me and throwing rocks and dirt and stones at me, but it may be that God's told him to do this. He may be doing this. This may be God doing this through him. So who's to stop him? But, you know, if he's not doing this because of God, then maybe God will reward me for accepting and for allowing this to happen. Okay? So he allows him to go on. Now, what about Mephibosheth? Let's look back at him, because we do have some stories about him here. Why had was he part of this entourage? Okay, he had been living in David's household. Was he coming along? Chapter 16, at the beginning of it. When David had gone a short distance beyond the summit, there was Ziba, the servant or the steward of Mephibosheth, waiting to meet him. He had a string of donkeys saddled and loaded with 200 loaves of bread, 100 cakes of raisins, 100 cakes of figs, and a skin of wine. The king asked Ziba, why have you brought these? Ziba answered, the donkeys are for your king's household to ride on. The bread and fruit are for the men to eat, and the wine is to refresh those who become exhausted in the desert. The king then asked, okay, well, where is your master's grandson? That is, where is Mephibosheth? Ziba said to him, he's staying in Jerusalem because he thinks, today the house of Israel will give me back my grandfather's kingdom. Okay? In other words, he thinks he's going to get to be king, so that's why he stayed. He's not supporting you, David, but I'm supporting you. Then the king said to Ziba, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours. I humbly bow, Ziba said. May I find favor in your eyes, my lord the king. So Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, goes to David and says, hey, Mephibosheth's not on your side. He thinks he's going to get to be king now, but I'm on your side. And here's some gifts to help take care of you as you go through this. Okay, and so David then responds by saying, okay, everything that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours. If I get back to this king, then it's all yours now. So you see how Ziba sides with David here. Well, is that what Mephibosheth was doing? Was he kind of staging his own coup? Was he thinking that he's going to get to be king now? Turn back further to chapter 19, starting at verse, we'll start at 24. Mephibosheth, Saul's grandson, also went down to meet the king. This is after David does get back to Jerusalem. We'll see this next week's story. But Mephibosheth had not taken care of his feet or trimmed his mustache or washed his clothes from the day that the king left until the day that he returned safely. Does that sound like someone who thinks he's going to get to be king now? When he came from Jerusalem to meet the king asked him, why didn't you go with me, Mephibosheth? He said, my lord, the king, since I, your servant, have lain, I said, I'll have my donkey saddled and I'll ride on it so I can go with the king. But Ziba, my servant, betrayed me. And he slandered my servant. He slandered me to my lord, the king, you. My lord, the king, is like an angel of God, so do whatever pleases you. Okay, God's given you discernment, so, you know, react to this however you feel is right. All of my grandfather's descendants deserve nothing but death from my lord, the king, but you gave your servant a place among those who sat at your table. So what right do I have to make any more appeals to the king? Okay, so he's taking a very humble answer here, and he says, the reason I didn't go with you is because I couldn't. I'm lame. And I had asked Ziba to go saddle up a donkey and set me on it so that I could go and join you, but he betrayed me. And he went and he told this horrible story to you about me trying to become king here. Okay, well, how does David react to this? Here he's got two totally different stories. Ziba sounded pretty sincere, and he had given all of Mephibosheth's belongings to Ziba. Now Mephibosheth is telling him that something else happened, and he seems pretty sincere. So how does David deal with these conflicting stories? Verse 29. The king said to Mephibosheth, why say more? I don't know. I order you and Ziba to divide the fields. Okay, so he couldn't figure out who was telling the truth and who was lying. So that he didn't make a bad decision, he said, okay, this is only going to be half bad. I split up the property between both of you. Okay, so told him to split it all. All right, David is runaway. Now Absalom then comes into Jerusalem from Hebron, and what is his first act that will help secure his kingship? Verse 15 of chapter 16. Meanwhile, Absalom and all the men of Israel came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel, okay, remember Ahithophel, the advisor, he was with him. Then, verse 20, Absalom said to Ahithophel, give us your advice. What should we do now? Ahithophel said, lie with your father's concubines. And we see in the previous chapter that when David left, he left 10 of his concubines there in Jerusalem to take care of the palace. So he kind of set the stage for this too. And so 10 of them were there. And Ahithophel said, lie with your father's concubines whom he left to take care of the palace. Then all of Israel will hear that you have made yourself a stench in your father's nostrils, and the hands of everyone with you will be strengthened. So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof of the palace, and he lay with his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Okay. So he lay in public with the 10 concubines that his father David had left. What's the purpose of that? Well, we've seen something like this before. If you turn back to chapter 3 and look at verses 6 and 7, you see that this is when David was king over Judah, but all the other tribes had the son. There was one more son of Saul at this time, and that was Ishbosheth. And Abner again was the commander in chief, or the commander of Ishbosheth's army. And we see in verse 6 that during the war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner had been strengthening his own position in the house of Saul. Now, Saul had had a concubine named Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, and Ishbosheth said to Abner, why did you sleep with my father's concubine? So here we see Ishbosheth accused Abner of doing this with one of Saul's concubines. And this accusation was a big accusation. It was basically an accusation of treason, because whoever laid claim to a concubine of the king or the previous king was laying claim to becoming the next king. Okay, what was Saul is now mine is the way that would be viewed. If Abner had taken that concubine. And so Ishbosheth accused him of that. He hadn't done that, and we see his reaction is to, okay, well, forget you, Ishbosheth, I'm going over to David's side. And so we have that story then. So here we see that's what Absalom does. He's showing everybody that I lay claim to my father's kingdom. I'm now the new king, and I want everybody to see this. And so he takes David's concubines, but not just takes it, but he wants to make sure everybody sees this, that everybody knows it, and he does so in public viewing on the rooftop of the palace. Now, what's interesting is this is something that David had been told was going to happen. After the Bathsheba incident, when Nathan was accusing him, and he confessed and repented, and then Nathan said, okay, you're forgiven, but you still have consequences. Part of that consequence, back in chapter 12, verse 11, Nathan says, this is what the Lord says, out of your own household I'm going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. You did this with Bathsheba in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all of Israel. Okay? And that's what's happening here, is Absalom is doing exactly what Nathan said would happen. Okay? Someone close to David? Of course, his own son, the heir apparent, the next one in line for the crown, has now set himself up and is doing this. Okay, so that's Absalom's first act as king, is to try to help everyone see that he is the king. Well, David is in hiding, and he needs to know what's going on. He's got to defend himself. He's got to figure a way to get back as king. He sets up a little spy network. We see some of that in chapter 15. Verse 27. The king also said to Zadok the priest, "Aren't you a seer? Go back to the city in peace with your son Ahimaaz and Jonathan the son of Abiathar. You and Abiathar, take your two sons with you. I will wait at the fords in the desert until word comes from you to inform me." So Zadok and Abiathar took the Ark of God back to Jerusalem and stayed there. So when he sent the Ark back, he also sent it back with Zadok and Abiathar the priests and their sons and said, "Okay, y'all be spies for me and send word through your sons. I'll be waiting at the fords. Have them come tell me things that I need to know, okay, of what's going on." And then we also see in verse 31 that David had been told that Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. Okay, was Ahithophel involved in the coup? No, but he was present when Absalom decided he was going to be king and announced it, so he therefore is recognized as being part of the conspirators. So David prayed, "O Lord, turn Ahithophel's counsel into foolishness." Okay, God's the source of wisdom. Ahithophel is recognized as a very wise advisor, and David prays to God, "Don't let him be wise. Don't let his advice be good." Then David arrived at the summit where people used to worship God, and Hushai, the Archite, was there to meet him, his robe torn and dust on his head. So Hushai was another advisor, and he came and met David at this place. And he was all upset, as you can see, his robe torn and dust on his head. He was in mourning. David said to him, "You know, if you go with me, you'll be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, 'I will be your servant, O king. I was your father's servant in the past, and now I'll be your servant,' then you can help me by frustrating Ahithophel's advice. Won't the priests Zadok and Abiathar be there with you? Tell them anything you hear in the king's palace. Their two sons, Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, and Jonathan, son of Abiathar, are there with them. Send them to me with anything you hear." So David's friend Hushai arrived at Jerusalem just as Absalom was entering the city. Okay, so he also plants his friend and advisor Hushai to go and spy things out. We see at the end of chapter 16 where Absalom sees Hushai, and he's a little suspicious here too. You see here Hushai in verse 16 goes to Absalom and says, "Long live the king, long live the king." And Absalom says, "What kind of friend are you? Why didn't you go with your friend?" And Hushai says, "No, the one chosen by Yahweh, by these people, and by all the men of Israel, his I will be, and I will remain with him. Okay, I was serving your father because he was chosen by God, but now you're chosen, and so I'm going to serve you. Furthermore, whom should I serve? Should I not serve the son? Just as I served your father, so I will serve you." Okay, so that you see the wise way that Hushai presented himself to Absalom and got Absalom to accept him. So was Hushai successful in frustrating Ahithophel's advice? Chapter 17, verse 6. When Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom said, "Ahithophel has given this advice. Should we do what he says? If not, then give us your opinion." Hushai replied to Absalom, "Hoo-hoo. The advice that Ahithophel has given is not good this time." And then he goes on and gives some other advice. This is advice on how should they pursue David. Okay? And then verse 14, after Hushai gives his advice, Absalom and all the men of Israel said, "The advice of Hushai the Archite is better than that of Ahithophel." For the Lord had determined to frustrate the good advice of Ahithophel in order to bring disaster on Absalom. Okay, so what David sent Hushai to Absalom for was being accomplished here. That Absalom was not listening to the good advice of Ahithophel. Instead, he was listening to bad advice from Hushai, who did a good job of presenting it as good advice. Okay, so that turned out. How did Ahithophel react when Absalom took Hushai's poor advice instead of his good advice, and he realized that Absalom was doomed because of this? Verse 23, when Ahithophel saw that his advice had not been followed, he saddled his donkey and set out for his house in his hometown. He put his house in order, and then he hanged himself. So he died and was buried in his father's tomb. Okay? So he hung himself. Why? Because he was upset that his advice had not been taken? No, he was upset because he knew that Absalom's kingship would be doomed, that David would win, that Absalom is listening to bad advice that is not of God. David would end up winning. He, Ahithophel, he felt that he would then be punished by David for siding with his enemy, and so he went ahead and took his own life here. So, did Hushai follow his role as a spy for David? You see, he's giving advice to Absalom. Does he also act as a spy? Verse 15. Hushai told Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, Ahithophel had advised Absalom and the elders of Israel to do such and such, but I advise him to do so and so. Now, send a message immediately and tell David, do not spend the night at the fords in the desert. Okay, they'll come get you there. Cross over without fail, or the king and all the people with him will be swallowed up. Okay, so he sends word to David. And so you see he's serving as a spy and sends word to David, not to stay where he is, but get across the Jordan River to the other side. Now, Jonathan and Ahimaaz, the two sons of the priests, they are then to go and to get this message to David, but they're almost caught before they can get word to David. We see that in the next verses. Jonathan and Ahimaaz were staying at Enrogel. Okay, it wasn't safe for them to stay in Jerusalem, because if they were to take word to David, they'd leave Jerusalem and they could be stopped and caught and they'd be seen and, you know, why are you leaving? That kind of thing. So they were staying outside. A servant girl was to go and inform them, and then they were to go and to tell King David, for they could not risk being seen entering the city. Okay, so they were waiting, and things had been worked out to where some servant girl who wouldn't raise any suspicion would go give them whatever message it needed to get to David. But, verse 18, a young man saw them and went and told Absalom. So the two of them left quickly and went to the house of a man in Bahurim. He had a well in his courtyard, and they climbed down into it. His wife took a covering and spread it out over the opening of the well and scattered grain over it. No one knew anything about it. Kind of sounds like the, what do they call them, rat holes that Saddam Hussein was found in. So they went and they hid in this well so that when Absalom's men, in verse 20, came to the woman at the house, they asked, where's Ahimaaz and Jonathan? And she answered them, oh, they crossed over the brook. And the man searched and looked all over but found no one, so they returned to Jerusalem. Okay, so they hid from Absalom's men. Almost caught, but they hid. And then they took off once the men went back. So where did, after David received this message from Hushai, where did he go? Verse 21, after the men had gone, the two climbed out of the well and went to inform King David. They said to him, set out across the river at once. Ahithophel had advised such and such against you. So David and all the people with him set out and crossed the Jordan. By daybreak, no one was left who had not crossed the Jordan. David went to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. So you see, Absalom and his men are pursuing David. Okay, they're following advice. We didn't read it, but at the beginning of chapter 17, the advice that that Hushai had given him. Okay, so David knew what was going on here, and eventually they'd meet. Okay, but David wouldn't be a sitting duck. David would have an advantage in this battle. Okay. The Israelites and Absalom camped in the land of Gilead, verse 26. So they were on the other side of the Jordan. So they're all over on the east side of the Jordan in the land of Gilead. By the way, where David went to Mahanaim is when Saul died, when he was killed by the Philistines, his only remaining son, Ishbosheth, he ran to Mahanaim to be safe. So that little interesting parallel there. And you see that when he's there in Mahanaim that he gets some support from some of the people there. They bring him some food and take care of him there. Okay, so people are making friends with the king who's in need of help. Well, battle time comes. Okay, David musters the men who's with him and appoints over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. Okay, because he's only got part of the army with him here. But he doesn't go into battle with them like a king normally does. Why not? Well, David, verse 2, sent the troops out, a third under the command of Joab, okay, his commander, the commander of his army, a third under Joab's brother Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, and a third under Ittai, the Gittite, okay, who was a foreigner who had 600 men with him. We skipped one of those verses that talk about that. And so he sent a third of the troops under Ittai, the Gittite, who had pledged to defend David, whatever it took. The king told the troops, "I myself will surely march out with you." But the men said, "No, you must not go out. If we're forced to flee, they won't care about us. Even if half of us die, they don't care. But you are worth 10,000 of us. It would be better now for you to give us support from the city." So the king said, "I'll do whatever seems best to you." So the king stood beside the gate while all the men marched out in units of hundreds and of thousands. Okay, so David wanted to go out to battle with them, but they said, "No, you are the target. You are the prize. You are the goal. If you come out and if we have to retreat, we need to be able to retreat and not have to worry about you." And they're not going to care about anything. If they get you, that's all that matters. So you're best to be safe here in this city. Okay, so he stays there. Now, before the troops march out to battle, David gives one more command here. Verse 5, he says, the king commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, "Be gentle with the young man Absalom, for my sake." And all the troops heard the king giving orders concerning Absalom to each of the commanders. So here, you know, how does David feel about Absalom? He still loves him. It's still his son. He still longs for him, even though Absalom is trying to kill David, that Absalom is taking the kingship that is rightfully David's. Absalom is staging a coup, but David doesn't want him dead. You saw the respect that he had for Saul. Now you see this is handled by a father's love for a son. And even though all these soldiers are going out to risk their lives, he tells them, "Bring Absalom back alive. Okay, keep him safe. Take care of him. Okay, be careful with him." Okay, not a very good thing to say to the troops going out to fight for you. So God gives victory to David, as you would expect. How does that happen? Verse 6, the army marched into the field to fight Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. So you've got this thick forest where the fighting happens. There, the army of Israel was defeated by David's men, and the casualty that day was great. 20,000 men. Huge, huge loss of life. The battle spread out over the whole countryside, and the forest claimed more lives that day than the sword. So you see, God got involved, and God won the victory. The forest claimed more lives. That forest is filled with ravines and cliffs and marshes, so some of the soldiers died that way. And you see, 20,000 were killed here. Well, what about Absalom? Verse 9, now Absalom happened to meet David's men. He was riding his mule, and as the mule went under the thick branches while he was running away of a large oak, Absalom's head got caught in the tree. He was left hanging in midair while the mule he was riding kept on going. Now you notice the words here. You probably have this picture in your mind from Sunday school days that he's caught by his hair and hanging by this long flowing hair. And that may be the case. Here it says that his head was caught in a tree, so it could just be also that his head got caught in a branch or whatever, and he was hanging there. It's not really clear. It could be his hair, it could be his head, but nonetheless, he's hanging there defenseless. So what happens? Verse 10, when one of the men saw this, he told Joab, "I just saw Absalom hanging in an oak tree." Joab said to that man who told him this, "What? You saw him? Why didn't you strike him to the ground right there? I would have had to give you 10 shekels of silver and a warrior's belt." But the man said, "Oh, even if 1,000 shekels were weighed out into my hands, I wouldn't lift my hand against the king's son. In our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, protect the young man Absalom for my sake. And if I had put my life in jeopardy, and nothing's hidden from the king, you would have kept your distance from me." Okay, so this soldier who had seen Absalom hanging in the tree didn't kill him, because he had heard David's command, and he knew that if, and Joab said, you should have killed him. And he said, well, if I had, the king would find out about it, and I'd be a dead man. And you wouldn't stand and support me. You would let me take the heat. Okay? So Joab says in verse 14, I'm not going to wait like this for you. So he took three javelins in his hand and plunged them into Absalom's heart while Absalom was still hanging alive in the oak tree. And then he had 10 of his armor bearers surrounded Absalom, struck him, and killed him. Now, don't you think he was already dead with the three javelins in his heart? He's making sure. Okay, he's a little overkill here, overzealousness on Joab's part here. Then Joab sounded the trumpet, and the troops stopped pursuing Israel, for Joab halted them. Okay, so Joab killed Absalom, got rid of the threat. Joab realized that if Absalom lives, that there's still this threat here. He's got to get rid of the threat, even though David didn't want that. Okay, he then erects a monument. Verse 17, they took Absalom, threw him into a big pit in the forest, and piled up a large heap of rocks over him. Meanwhile, all the Israelites fled to their homes. Okay, so they dug this big pit, buried him deep in this pit, and then piled a huge pile of rocks on there, something that you would do for an evil person. That's a sign of burying a person with rocks all over him is a mark of an evil person. So he did that. Is that the kind of monument that Absalom would have wanted? Now, verse 18, during his lifetime, Absalom had taken a pillar and erected it in the king's valley as a monument to himself. For he thought, I have no son to carry on the memory of my name. So he named the pillar after himself, and it's called Absalom's Monument to this day. So, no, it's not the kind of monument that Absalom wanted for himself. He had already made one for himself in the king's valley. And this verse also tells us that he had no son, so his lineage then, his intended lineage there stopped. Okay, so David is now safe. David is no longer threatened by Absalom. Absalom's his opponent is dead. And then in the next verses we have the story of getting the word to them. We see that Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, wanted to go bring word to David to tell him what was going on. And Joab says, no, it's not right for you to do that because this isn't good news. David's not going to like this, that his son is dead. So you shouldn't take this. You should be the bearer of good news, not bad news. So he sends a Cushite, some foreigner, to go and bring word to David. And then after the Cushite took off running, then Ahimaaz said, come on, let me go. Just let me run after him. Let me run behind the Cushite. The Cushite can get there first, but then I want to get there and console or whatever. I want to be there too. And Joab said, why do you want to go? Okay, go. So he takes off running, and he takes a shortcut and gets there before the Cushite. And as he nears the town where David is, they see him running, and they go, oh, there's one running, and here comes another one running. The first one runs kind of like Ahimaaz does. Maybe that's Ahimaaz, and David goes, oh, good, because Ahimaaz would only be bringing good news. Ahimaaz arrives first, and then in verse 28, he calls out to the king, all is well. He bows down before the king with his face to the ground and said, praise be to Yahweh your God. He has delivered up the men who lifted their hands against my lord the king. The threat is over. We've won the victory. And what is David's reaction to that? Is the young man Absalom safe, he says? Ahimaaz answered, well, I saw great confusion just as Joab was about to send the king's servant and me, your servant, but I don't know what it was. Okay, so he plays dumb on this part. Okay, he doesn't want to bring the bad news. He's brought the good news about the victory. And then the king says, stand aside and wait here. So he stepped aside and stood there. And then the Cushite arrived and said, my lord the king, hear the good news. The Lord has delivered you today from all who rose up against you. Well, David already knows this. He's already heard the good news. And the king said to the Cushite, is the young man Absalom safe? The Cushite replied, oh, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you to harm you be like that young man. So in other words, no, he's not okay. How did, so you see that's his one concern. His concern is not so much the victory, his concern is for his son. How does David react to the news that he's got this victory? The king was shaken. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. As he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." So you see, he's not thrilled about the victory. Instead, he's upset that his son was killed, even though his son wanted him dead. How did this affect the people who had fought for David, though? We'll go on, verse 9, chapter 19. Joab was told, "The king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. And for the whole army, the victory that day was turned into mourning, because on that day the troops heard it said that the king is grieving for his son. So the men stole into the city that day, just as men steal in who are ashamed when they flee from battle." Okay? So this was a great victory. They had a great victory and saved the kingdom, saved the king, and yet they have to act like losers because the king is upset about his son being killed. Well, Joab was upset by this. Verse 5. Joab went into the house of the king and said, "Today you have humiliated all of your men who have just saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and concubines. You love those who hate you and hate those who love you. You've made it clear today that the commanders and their men mean nothing to you. I see that you would be pleased if Absalom were alive today and all of us were dead." Okay? Here, all these people risk their lives for you, and you don't care. You're upset because your son was killed, the one that we were fighting against, the one who threatened you, the one that created this problem, and you don't care that we've got victory, that we were saved. And he says to David, "Now, go out and encourage your men, because I swear by the Lord that if you don't go out, not a man will be left with you by nightfall. This will be worse for you than all the calamities that have come upon you from your youth until now." Okay? So Joab went to David and said, "You're showing contempt for the people who risked their very lives and fought for you and protected you, and you're showing this contempt to them. You've got to change. You've got to go out and show your support to them." So did David understand Joab's concern? Verse 8. "So the king got up and took his seat in the gateway. When the men were told the king is sitting in his gateway, they all came before him." His poor reaction here threatened what was just saved, threatened his kingship, because the men could have turned on him. But yet, Joab had a more discerning mind here and convinced him to go out and to allow the people to recognize this victory. Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we thank you for the stories that you give us in your scriptures. We thank you for showing us the good stories and the bad, the evil that permeates within a family, how it grows, and how, not just within a family, but how evil can build upon evil. And as people seek revenge against others for a sin, that it gets worse and worse. We ask you to forgive us when we're guilty of that, when we try to take our revenge and not leave things in your hands. Forgive us. Accept our confession, accept our repentance, restore us to you just as you've promised to do through the blood of your Son, Jesus Christ. Keep us strong so that we don't succumb to the temptations that Satan throws our ways, as did Amnon, as did Absalom, as did David. Help us to look to you for guidance and strength as we encounter the arrows of temptation from Satan. In Christ's name. Amen.